Okay, so we'll continue. That you were speaking about the fact that there was tremendous pressure on the government and on Christiani to.
I sometimes felt that the UN negotiating team had lost perspective of the political landscape of El Salvador, of the role that the armed forces played, how fragile the government was, how fragile it was going to become. But at the same time, I realized that if they were not pushed enough, they would not bend the minimum that they had to bend. So in hindsight, I think it was wise.
Yeah.
To push. Otherwise, they would not have reached the agreement they would reach.
Right. So now we've been talking primarily about the role that Venezuela and the friends had played in the negotiation process. After the agreement was signed in January in Chapultepec in Mexico, and the implementation had to begin, what kinds of role then did the friends play? And was there a change then in the role?
Then, at that time, we became members of the Security Council. And remember, according to the agreement and the peace agreement, we would send, you know, we had the United Nations mission in El Salvador, and the fact that Spain and Venezuela were in the Security Council together with the United States made us very increase our authority on both parties to continue exercising certain pressures on them to comply. So actually, we accompanied the friends, accompanied the process until the same.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the activity was, they had did not have the same intensity as before, mm-hmm. but every time there was a crisis, as a matter of fact, a few months ago, De Soto had the idea to, before Boutros left, to ask the former four friends of El Salvador to go on a mission to present an evaluation of the peace process.
Okay.
And we had accepted, and at the end there were some internal conflicts, etc., and they decided to postpone it because they wanted the same people who had negotiated to come and give a sort of a post-mortem examination, which I think would have been very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was some opposing, I never knew exactly what happened, but there were some opposing forces inside. And at the same time, by that time, the president of El Salvador, now, I think was a little fed up with the UN intervening and, you know, giving always the impression that they were still under the tutoring of the United Nations. They wanted to get rid of the United Nations as quickly as possible, which they have.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we never went back.
You didn't.
I've been back many times. I've been with Cristiani several times on other issues, but not on that.
Okay. In terms of the implementation, there were a few times when the different parties met with the group of friends to complain that things were not moving along.
Yes.
And were you
part of those
meetings? Yeah, what kinds of complaints?
Fundamentally, for example, the land distribution became a very land distribution, the police reform. Then, of course, at the beginning, the Truth Commission.
Yeah, okay.
That was a very touchy one. Funny enough, at the end, the Truth Commission forgot me,
mm-hmm.
while the land problems continued to be the haunting process, because, of course, at the end, it was an issue of poverty.
Yeah, okay. Right.
So, I mean, the fundamental issue, the clashes of El Salvador were of economic nature.
Yeah.
And they could not be solved by a peace agreement. We had to resolve through the development process, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Where, and there are a lot of complaints, and still not resolved. And many times we thought the government was not complying, or was not, especially on the economic side, they didn't have enough resources. The international community never gave the financial support that they should have. We insisted a lot on that. This is, you know, you can change the police, you can downsize the armed forces, but you have to give financial support for this to happen. for development. These are very laborious people, as you know, these Ecuadorians are. But they never got the strong financial support that the peace process would have required, which is taking place in Haiti. I mean, we are replicating the same experience in Haiti.
Did Venezuela have resources that they would use as incentives throughout the implementation process?
We had with Mexico what we call the San Jose Agreement. You know, would give them oil at preferential prices. That comes from Pérez's first government since 1974. When the oil crisis, you know, the oil became very expensive. We started a program for the Caribbean and Central American countries called the Acuerdo de San Jose, the San Jose Agreement, by which we would give them on preferential terms oil. So El Salvador was receiving that support. Plus, we were part of the United Nations mission in El Salvador, too.
You had personnel there.
We had a lot of officers and soldiers. By the way, some of the people who later attempted a coup in Venezuela had been in El Salvador as part of the
attempted coup with the tank going up the
stairs. Well, some of these people, some of these commanders and captains had been in the UNASAL mission in El Salvador. They were training for a coup there.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So, we went many times, and then we'll meet with the Salvador. The minister will come. Santa Maria will come here, and then we come with the ambassador. You know, very interesting. You should speak to the ambassador of El Salvador because he's been through the whole process.
Okay.
He's been since 1990 up to now. So he has enjoyed the confidence of both governments.
Okay, that's right.
And he never lost the confidence of the FMNLI. It was a very difficult position. You know, I greatly admire that.
This guy,
you know, always represented his country in the midst of this situation. So, I mean, if somebody could give you some useful information, even on the record, it's him. Castaneda,
okay.
Ricardo Castaneda.
Definitely.
You call him, tell him, Diego told me, you know, you must speak to me.
Okay.
Because he was deputy foreign minister before he came here.
Okay.
And he's in the seventh or eighth year in the United Nations.
That's wonderful. Good. I'll definitely get in touch with him. That's important.
So we call him, you know, every time we're going to extend the mission, the UNISAL, you know, the Secretary General would meet with us, we'd give him our advice, we met with Boutros many times on that.
Yeah.
Of course, with De Soto. But then it became, you know, an exercise in the implementation.
Right.
You know.
Well, now you mentioned that at one point there were, we've heard the complaints on the rebel side.
Yeah.
That the police were not being reformed properly and so forth.
Yeah.
But there was also the complaints on the government side that weapons were being found in secret hiding places and so forth.
We did.
How did that information come to you? Was that presented to the group of friends in some way or another?
It would come through the United Nations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or it would be reported, the President of Salvador would call the President of Venezuela and then listen. Look what's happening here. And then, you know, the President of Venezuela would call me or call, now I would tell the Secretary General. So both parties move in that direction. Or the FMNL, you know, would get to see Pérez or the President of Mexico. At least Pérez, I knew. I don't know whether the President of Mexico.
Uh-huh.
I don't think the President of Mexico was involved personally. Mexicans are more formal. Any contact must have been through a foreign minister, something of that sort.
Okay.
Well, Pérez was the direct link to them. He didn't have any intermediaries.
Okay.
Of course, they could call Beatriz Rangel, which I recommend to you again if you speak to her.
Yeah.
Because of her notes.
Yeah.
And he was very much involved personally.
Okay.
So these people would complain to him. For example, what's happening with the police or what's happening with some of the officers who have been persecuted, etc.
Yeah.
But they would, you know, promise to us that they had given up all the arms, etc. And we'd come and find out that was all the truth. And, you know, we would lean on them and reprimand them and get very angry at them.
Okay.
So sometimes we have very tense conversation with them. Remember, the guerrillas, they were very much divided among themselves by the end of the process. So, I mean, I am sure some people they were lying among themselves. I mean, I don't think collectively they agreed to lie to us. I don't believe that.
Okay.
Because it was, I mean, very secret.
Okay, yeah. Well.
Please.
Right. Well, now I wanted to ask you some questions about Haiti. We've been talking primarily about El Salvador. But Venezuela then became a member of the Group of Friends on Haiti. Aristide had been overthrown on September 30th, 1991. So this was interweaving with the whole issues on El Salvador. How did Venezuela become a member of the Group of Friends on Haiti, and what was Venezuela's involvement in the issue of Haiti?
You know, it would be interesting if you take a look at the book that I gave you, because I relate to some of the things. But I will tell you in brush strokes.
Oh, okay.
When one of the few presidents who attended the inaugural of Aristide was the president of Venezuela.
I see, okay. And this is Perez.
Yeah, Perez.
Again.
Perez again.
Yeah.
The same. And Perez was very impressed by Aristide. I remember he told me, he said, this is small man, when he starts speaking, starts growing up. And Perez, with a man with so much arrogance on his own abilities, told me that. I was greatly impressed. And I said, you know, Diego, he says, this guy grows up when he speaks. He has such a magnetism
that
moves people in a way that I have seldom seen, he told me.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, then he's overthrown, and I call the president. And when, you know, he was... President sent a plane, actually sent a private plane from Venezuelan banker, a friend of ours, Jose Alvarez Stelling, sent a Gulfstream and went to get Aristide. I relate something what happened, you know, that night.
Uh-huh.
Then he went to Venezuela, you know, arrived in Venezuela in the early morning.
Sent the plane from Caracas to Port-au-Prince.
To Port-au-Prince.
Who had contacted Aristide to tell him that he could...
No. Our ambassador, it was a lady in Haiti.
I see.
Was told that, you know, Perez had urged before that Mitterrand and to Bush that we should help this new democracy.
Uh-huh.
And that's why he was involved. And then he got there. I called him next day. I called the president. I said, listen, I know that this is flying to Washington for the OAS meeting, again in a Venezuelan, this time in a Venezuelan government plane. And I said to him, he must come to the United Nations. I said to him, he's going to waste his time at the OAS. But I understand that that's a stop he must make.
Yeah.
But I should tell him that he should come here. And when he comes here, he should come straight to me, because I'd like to speak to him in order that he doesn't repeat the performance he had at the General Assembly the first time here.
Uh-huh.
As you remember, he spoke in 17 languages, so it was quite a mess.
Let me just get the sequence of events. He was overthrown on the 30th, and then your ambassador to Haiti, the Venezuelan woman, I've forgotten her name.
Blanca, let me see. I'll remember her
name. Then, did she organize Aristide's safe delivery out of Haiti?
No, she couldn't. These are related there, because you see, this lady was also very close to Aristide.
Yeah.
Aristide trusted her too. But by the time, Aristide was a prisoner. So when we sent the plane, we didn't know how, you know, whether he would be at the airport or not be at the airport. Finally, they took him to the airport. There's a lot of speculation that where the role played.
Were the military holding him?
Were the military holding him?
Oh.
Actually, they had him as a prisoner at the airport. I mean, they were, you know, when they had him. And when our plane landed, you know, we sent a doctor, a physician, among the people, you know, who got him into the plane. And he thought he was going to be killed. He told me, I mean, he thought he was going to be killed before he got into the plane.
Oh, I see.
But at that time, the French were unnoticed, the U.S. was unnoticed, we were unnoticed.
Okay.
So he lands in Venezuela, you know, taken to the presidential guest house.
Okay.
And a couple of days afterwards, he's in Washington.
Okay. And then Venezuela...
We send him again here in our plane, he comes here.
Uh-huh, to Washington first.
And then I meet with him, and then I try to negotiate, personally, the Colombian ambassador, Fernando Cepeda, the Mexican ambassador, Jorge Montaño, and myself,
mm-hmm.
went to see the president of the Security Council, who was the Indian ambassador, Chimaya Garikan, who later became
Undersecretary. Yes,
Garikan was, at that month, the president of the Security Council. And we went to see Gary Khan. I said, listen, Jeremiah, there's been this coup. Aristides, part of the first elected president of Haiti, thanks to the United Nations contribution, you remember?
Yes.
Organization.
Yeah.
This is a United Nations issue.
Yeah.
You must receive Aristide in a meeting.
Yeah, okay.
He, you know, did not offer anything. This was around 6 o'clock in the afternoon. There was an informal consultation about that. And we spoke also to the Ecuadorian ambassador, who was the Latin American member, together with Cuba, in the council at the moment.
Okay.
Later on, we found out that the Ecuadorians, you know, very formal. He's now the foreign minister of Ecuador. He had also been a very distinguished man, Jose Ayala Lasso.
Yes.
And Pepe Ayala, you know, very formal, you know, why should this issue, this is a regional issue, why should it come to the Security Council? Discussion went around to a point that when Pickering came out, said to me, you know, and Alex Watson said to me, I don't understand why Pepe, Jose Ayala, took this position when we had already approved to get, the United States was also very much in our favor, to get the Aristide into the meeting. Mm-hmm. But the position taken by Cuba, by China, by Ecuador, fundamentally, that I know of, stopped from him coming to a meeting, to a formal meeting of the Security Council. So we got the second best option. You know, we start pressing it, and I said to them, can't listen, we're going to bring the whole Latin American group, it's going to be a major. And then they accepted that the council would meet in the official room, and he would come in, he would speak, and then he would leave. But they would give him his 50 minutes before court. Mm-hmm. So actually, then Aristide comes to the United Nations around 7 o'clock, and I met with him in a small room next to the Security Council, and I explained to him, as it is present, mm-hmm. the Security Council is not the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. The Security Council is a very serious procedure. You know, you cannot speak here in 17 languages or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I will tell you a comment about that later. And then I went back to, in that time I was not a member of the Security Council, so I sat in the sort of a gallery overlooking the former room.
Yeah.
And I remember I still came in, and the first time I was in this in the United Nations, the people stood up. This small frail man came, and the Security Council members stood up.
And they stood.
And then he sat, you know, he sat on the table, his hands folded, that is, took certain distance from the table, and began speaking very softly on the importance of democracy, peace. I mean, never you'd hear a man, you know, fighting for his life or acute. No, it was a very peaceful, mild, with a strong concept, but, you know, very well delivered, with no notes. The guy didn't mince one word. He spoke very well. He spoke, you know, he speaks an immaculate French. He speaks many other languages immaculately too, as well.
Yeah, and this language that he spoke at that time, in French.
And I remember the silence. The whole room was packed. It was a major silence. So it was the you'd feel the man had a great moral bearing, weight. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, everybody expected him to come, you know, like a bomb, mm-hmm. like this usual in the United Nations. It was the opposite.
It was the opposite.
So, you know, there started a long process of great conflicts in our own region.
Yeah.
Then 2 months later, we entered the Security Council.
Okay.
And that's when, you know, we start pushing for to bring the issue of the Latin, of the Haiti to the Security Council.
Now, when did the Group of Friends form? And at that point, you were already a member of the Group of Friends on El Salvador,
yes.
and had seen that process move very successfully. So how did it form on Haiti?
It was the new Secretary General.
Yeah.
Boutros Ghali.
Yeah.
Boutros Ghali had great sympathy for the case of Haiti.
Okay.
As you will see, he played a very important role. Boutros Now, we'll tell you some confidential matter that Boutros decided that he should have put together France, the United States, Canada, and Venezuela at the France. Why? In that time, Mitterrand, Bush, Mulroney, and Perez had a very good rapport, and also with Boutros Lani. I say in this book that it was Perez who proposed to Mitterrand, you know, that they should support this process originally. And then Perez, when Mitterrand visited Venezuela, and it isn't in his Perez records, he said to Mitterrand, you know, we must do something for Haiti. And then Mitterrand said yes, but he did not respond quickly. So Perez called Mulroney and asked Mulroney to speak to Mitterrand.
Yeah, Mulroney of Canada.
Canada,
mm-hmm.
The Prime Minister, and to speak to Bush. He was very close to Bush.
Uh-huh.
And Mulroney became very, very involved, engaged immediately. And Mulroney was the one who called Mitterrand and called Bush. And that's how this whole thing came together.
Okay, okay.
Then, you know, we started then in the Security Council. There was France, the United States, and Venezuela. Three of the four friends were in the Security Council. Canada was not. And we started looking for ways to bring this to the Security Council immediately.
Okay.
There was a major resistance in the Latin American group. Major resistance.
And why was that?
The Mexicans, the Brazilians, the Ecuadorians, Uruguayans, very much opposed, because the Security Council is to bring issues of, you know, of peace, of issues that threaten the international peace and security. Haiti did not did not threaten international peace and security. Their foreign ministers were being very formal about how to handle this issue.
No, and there was the issue of the OAS.
Well, and then Brazil had the issue. The Secretary General of the OAS was a Brazilian.
Oh, Baena Suarez. Yeah.
But that time, now we are in 1992.
Yeah. Okay.
Because this is one of these results, 1993. Brazil enters the Security Council, substituting Ecuador. See, Ecuador, yes, 1993. Because in 1993 is when we get Haiti to the Security Council. There was a major resistance in the Latin American community, who has always a very formal and conventional handling of international issues. Sovereignty, you know, certain icons involving into internal situation. More or less is the policy that China takes on many of these issues. This is intervening into the sovereignty of the national issue, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So two sides were taken very quickly in Latin America. We took one side, and we became very, very active with Venezuela, with the CARICOM countries, which were 13 members. And then the CARICOM countries and ourselves began lobbying all over the United Nations. But we had at that time, even in my own government, I had to keep away from our ambassador, the OAS, what we were doing at the United Nations. Because he would call me every day to find out, you know, to tell me that we should not accept Haiti, because this was a regional issue, it was not an international issue. At the same time, the Brazilian Secretary General was pushing his own ambassador, Boutros, would speak to me personally, you know, and said, you know, you must find an excuse to bring Haiti here, you know. I remember once he said to me, we have to link this to a threat to the Dominican Republic, which is, you know, which is potentially a fact.
Yeah, sure.
He said, you know, this would entails a threat to the peace, and the, you know, he really wanted us to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a very imaginative solution to the issue. He appointed as commissioner, his representative, Dante Caputo. You remember the Argentinian?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
But he proposed to the OAS, why don't we appoint together one?
That's right.
Two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And which Baena accepted.
And Dante being from Argentina.
And Dante was Argentina, so they thought that maybe we'll have the same position of the, as the Brazilians. So they thought that that would calm us. Then, you know, a lot of resolutions start until we were able to bring under the sponsorship of the United States, France, and Venezuela, the resolution to the Security Council. You know, when we became involved with the Governors Islands Agreement, what later on became the final return of our friendly state. But the Latin Americans were very, the day before I took the resolution to the Security Council, my ambassador at the OAS called me and says, listen, Diego, what's going on there? I said, well, nothing special. This is going to happen, what is going to happen? No, not very much is going to happen. And, you know, an hour later, I took it to the Security Council, you know, and I gave a very important, significant speech, you know, push it, and we got it approved. He called in the afternoon, furious. I mean, I said, why? They said, I couldn't tell you because, you know, you would have tried to stop it one way or another. I don't know why. But the president of Venezuela was in total support of what I was doing. So, in a way, I think it was very wise and great. In the OAS, it kept them at bay, in peace, but yeah, we will not do anything. And at the international forum, we would move ahead very fast. So
now,
we did not offend the OAS,
yeah,
and we did not offend the international community.
Now, the resolution that you're referring to, was this the resolution to impose sanctions on Haiti?
Yeah.
Okay, and that was a really key issue.
That was a significant step.
Yeah.
That was what created the Governor's Island, and Governor's Island is something, you know, one day we'll speak about it, right?
So in this case, when you were able to successfully orchestrate that, it took quite a while, because the Security Council had not wanted to take up that issue. So at that point, did you meet with the other members of the Friends Group? You had the French, the Canadian, and the U.S. And was there a consensus among that group that sanctions at this point was ready?
Very.
They were ready.
That
to
group worked like a clock.
Ah, okay.
The group of friends, in the case of Haiti, worked like a clock. You know, we're always very much attuned to each other's position. What we had to do was always done collectively.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there was no hanky-panky. I mean, it was really very unified action. And, you know, of course, we had to lobby all the members of the Security Council. And it was, I'm telling you, the role played by the CARICOM countries, because then we incorporated Africa into the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
54 members, you know. So we had, no worries, we had a lot of people really involved, and we started playing the racial card.
Okay.
I even wrote an article in the New York Times that I called Haiti the Black Bosnia. Which I should give it to you.
Yeah,
if you remember,
yeah.
I'll give it to you.
Yeah.
Which I said the Latin Americans do not care for Haiti because they are blacks and they don't think that they are Latins. Like the Europeans think that the Bosnians are Muslims. And so,
yeah.
I mean, it was more or less, and nobody cared very much what's happening in Haiti. This is a fact. I mean, the first victims of the of the Latin American lack of interest were the Haitians.
I see.
Latin Americans never gave very much importance to the case of Haiti.
In that case, Venezuela's role in the process was very important, because you were the only representative of Latin America in the France.
Oh, yes. But let me tell you something, more than Venezuela, was the president of Venezuela's committee. Because
the president.
Let me tell you something which is tragically ironic. When we brought Aristide to Venezuela, and 14 or 40 Haitians arrived to Venezuela, major scandal in public opinion. We're going to be inundated by these Haitians. What they were meaning was, we're going to be inundated by the black community. And that's when I wrote my article. This is amazing. You know, you criticize the United States, and they have thousands of Haitians all over the place. Now you get 40 Haitians, and you forget our whole history when Petion was the president of Haiti, financed these two incursions of Simon Bolivar into the Venezuelan independence. You know this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
Uh-huh. I have a speech on that, and I said, you know, short memories of the Venezuelan.
Yeah, yeah. So turn this on.
Over here.
Okay, so we were talking about Haiti.
Being the one of the two Latin Americans at the Security Council, I convened for a formal meeting the CARICOM countries and the Caribbean and Latin American group.
Yeah.
I convened them to a formal meeting to openly discuss this. And, you know, I brought this issue as a, this is beyond the international considerations. You know, Haiti is the poorest country in this continent. It is a bad country. It is impoverished, marginal, you know, etc. You know, I made a very strong political argument rather than to continue on the international law interpretations, whether this was a threat or not a threat to, mm-hmm. To international peace and security.
Yeah.
And we were able to move. They knew that we had the support of the Africans, the United States involved, the Europeans were collectively involved. And there was, somehow there was more resistance formally from some of the Latin American countries that were competing with China, Cuba, and those countries, you know, who didn't want the United Nations to get involved because they were, you know, scared that one day we'd get Cuba into the Security Council, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, China also had its traditional policy not to intervene. In this case, they abstained.
They abstained. Oh, I see. Okay.
The resume, we had 14 votes, and no one's approved.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question, because I think it's very interesting and complicated as to why the Latin American countries were resisting, you know, some of the issues that you were bringing
for
up.
For a traditional attitude that the United Nations not intervene in internal problems.
Right, right.
And second, that the Security Council should not handle an issue where international peace and security was not involved.
Okay. Because they wanted the OAS to be able to handle it instead?
Well, because I tell you, because nobody cared for Haiti. The United States cared for Haiti for one very important reason.
Yeah.
Because Miami was being invaded by Haiti. That's very reasonable.
Sure.
I mean, that was more than enough. It was not that the United States loved Haiti more than we did.
Yeah.
It was that the United States was more threatened. Actually, the greatest threat wasn't the United States.
Yeah.
Because they were going to get 500,000 Haitians overnight.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what prompted.
Sure.
I'm not saying that was the only reason, but that
but that made it an international issue.
That accelerated the concern and the United States decision.
Yeah.
You know, it was a natural one.
Yeah. The other question that I've had in my mind, was there resistance by some of the Latin American countries? Because there was a fear that the United Nations or the United States behind the United Nations might get involved, as it did in Haiti. And that then might set a precedence for getting involved in other Latin American countries if there were a military coup or something.
Absolutely so. Of course, that was not so openly said, but it was openly implied, and it was a reality. That was actually the foundation of their concern, was that.
Yeah.
Today is Haiti, tomorrow is us. And but, you know, and they took the luxury of being very formal and the consideration of a country like Haiti.
Yeah.
And I said something that I wonder, you know, the same consideration would be taken if it was Colombia or a more significant country.
Yeah.
I think the Latin, you know, they have been the victims of discrimination by their own colleagues in the region. Haiti, by absolutely.
Yeah. Now, just in terms of bringing Venezuela into this issue, when actually was that attempted coup in Venezuela?
It was in, the first one was in February 1992. I mean, we already had the coup.
Okay.
I had the coup 1 month after I was sitting in the Security Council.
Uh-huh.
I acted like nothing had happened, but it has happened.
Yeah.
And so a year before.
I wonder if that at all played a role in some of the active quality of President Pérez, because if there had been a military coup in Venezuela, would the United Nations have taken a stand against the military coup?
The OAS would have. The OAS.
Yeah.
You know, the OAS is totally meaningless for this exercise. I mean, poor Haiti had to wait for the OAS. And it still be, you know, kneeling in a church in Washington, still waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, every time you take something there, it is the end of the road. That's why we all realized that we had to bring it to the Perez was so great, and you know, I convinced Perez, said, listen, the venue is not the OAS.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a former one. The real issue is in the United Nations. So I explained to Perez that. And that's what we had in here.
Yeah.
That's what we had at the UN. And actually it was resolved.
Yeah.
I mean, actually it laid the groundwork for something to happen the way it happened later.
Now, in terms of, you know, bringing the issue and working with the friends and getting the resolution passed in the Security Council, you played a very important role. What about bringing along the members of the OAS? Were you able to play a kind of role in terms of convincing the OAS that their cooperation in this was important?
That was an impossible exercise. I mean, I didn't even went to see my colleague at the OAS, who was a very good friend of mine, to try to convince him. I mean, they had a culture, and the culture was original against ours, is very ecumenical, more universal. And actually, we had the sanctions. So they don't have the sanctions. We had the, you know, the Force of the Security Council.
Yeah.
It was something that they didn't have.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was no... I never received an instruction from my president to talk to our people at the OAS. Never. I did it on my own volition. But I never got one note to tell me, listen, coordinate or talk to them.
Uh-huh.
I think he left them doing their own exercise, which is very political and very rhetorical, and of reinforcement and, you know, this negotiation we had, some of the resolutions were very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Baena, you know, was very, very complicated mental decision. And Boutros, we had the advantage that Boutros was very militant.
Okay.
And wanted to bring Haiti to the Security Council.
Yeah.
That was very
yeah.
useful. And he was really genuinely convinced that the only way for Haiti was to bring it to the Security Council.
Yeah, okay. Now, I understand that in the group of friends in El Salvador, that the group of friends really wrote most of the drafts of the resolutions before they were presented to the Security Council. Was that the case
yes.
also with the friends
yes.
on Haiti?
The same thing.
Yeah.
And I think we were all very active. The four groups were very active. Of course, the issue of Haiti was going to be resolved again by the United States. I mean, there's no regional conflict where the presence of the United States was not needed. I mean, and at the end, it proved the fundamental one. What could we do? Help, you know, we send some policemen or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The Canadians were extremely useful.
Okay.
I would say, if I had to say who was more important, was the United States and Canada. On the support later on of Haiti. Now, mm-hmm. inside we were more useful because we were in the Security Council.
Yeah, okay.
And
Canada was not.
And Canada was not. They had just left the Security Council a couple of years before. It was a pity that had we been, the four of us together would have been, you know, a faster process. But Canada is a respectable country, enjoys great respect. We were able to use the Canadians very effectively in the region.
Mm-hmm.
But we all cooperate, and it operated like a clock. And we were working with the UN. Secretariat was also in the same wavelength that we were.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all working in the same direction. So the four friends and the UN Secretariat were very closely united.
Okay.
And we didn't have the differences that we had during the Salvadorian process.
Right.
With the United Nations Secretariat
mm-hmm.
or with the Secretary General.
Okay.
Here the Secretary General, the Secretariat, and the four friends were totally united.
Yeah. Now you mentioned that on El Salvador that you had had a special arrangement for Central American countries on the purchase of oil. Did you have a similar arrangement with Haiti?
I think so. I have
okay.
to go. I have to check
yeah.
it. And I think so because, I mean, Haiti was the poorest nation in the country.
Right.
So, I mean, I am sure. The problem is that, you know, when Haiti had a dictatorship, we were not giving them the oil. But at one time, remember, I had this interregnum where they had this lady, Trujillo, as president, you remember?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think during that time we did. We have always, during Perez times, Venezuela has been very supportive of Haiti. You know,
so that when you were proposing sanctions, which included an oil embargo,
yeah.
then that really did it involve
oh,
Venezuela?
Yes.
Because then
yes.
you would be involved
oh, yes.
in the oil embargo.
Actually, you know, at one point we threatened the Dominicans because the Dominicans were sabotaging. More than Dominicans, you know, they have a very uneasy relationship, as you know, because actually the independence of the Dominican Republic was independence of the Haitians. And there's a lot of bad blood between the two countries. And they were sabotaging because, you know, selling gas, you know. I remember
across their border.
Several meetings with the Dominican ambassador, you know, warning him, you know, that we were going to do something about it. You know, if we had to, we would propose, you know, that we give sanctions to the Dominican Republic because they were really sabotaging the...
Now, toward the end, actually, wasn't there a Security Council resolution to close that border?
Yeah, we did.
And to put some observers along that border?
But even though we had the service, they were, you know, impossible. They were, but they were strongly warned. By that time, they knew that, you know, we were taking a close look because there was a lot of military officers from the Dominican side making a lot of money selling oil. Like it happens every time there are sanctions. It's not the only place.
Okay, well, we have a few more minutes, and I wanted to go on to the third group of friends, which is Guatemala.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, you know, Venezuela has been involved in all these different groups. Yeah. So how was the group of friends on Guatemala set up, and what was Venezuela's role in that case?
This is different. You know, one day, the president of Mexico, president of Venezuela, the president of Colombia, met in Venezuela for a conference.
Okay.
And they agreed to create a group of friends of the president of Guatemala.
Of the president?
Of the president of Guatemala.
Of Guatemala. Of,
which was Carpio. Not Carpio. The one who tried to do a coup d'etat himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Try to do a la Fujimori. Well,
yeah.
Jorge, well, I will tell you a second. Then I get a call that I should go to Guatemala to meet with the president.
And you're...
I'm ambassador. I'm the security council.
Okay.
And I get a call from my president to see that I should go to Guatemala and meet with the president together with a Mexican who stayed, at that time was staying.
Sure, yeah.
And the... Colombian? The Colombian? Yes, the Colombian. The Spaniard was not here. And they wanted to get the same friends, Salvador to Guatemala.
Okay, so there was a direct link between the group of friends of El Salvador and Guatemala.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. And they called it the same nationalities. Mm-hmm. So we arrived in Guatemala to meet. I had been a friend of this gentleman long before he was president of Guatemala. And we had And we immediately realized there was a major mistake done by our presidents. Because instead of calling ourselves friends of the process...
Yeah, or you had been friends of the Secretary General up until
which was friends of the process.
Yeah.
Friends of the Secretary General. We were becoming friends of the President of Guatemala.
Uh-huh. Okay. Which was one party to the issue.
Like it was the higher instance. So... I remember the reactions among ourselves. I remember the first reaction was Tello. Mm-hmm. I was ambassador, and we had a very candid conversation with the president and the armed forces.
Uh-huh.
We had a meeting at the palace in the morning, the whole day. And I remember Tello saying, you know, we are friends of the process. And I met the president of Guatemala and said, well, you are my friends. And you know,
Chati. Thank you.
We did try to become on our own friends of the process.
Yeah.
Rather than a friend, because we immediately sensed that we're going to lose importance immediately.
Yeah, yeah. Now there's a distinction between the group of friends of the Secretary General, which was the title of the El Salvadoran group, but the title of the Guatemalan friends group is friends. A group of friends of the peace process.
Yeah, but you see...
But originally it was... He had set it up as friends of the president.
Yeah, I mean, that later, you know, it changed later on, you know, it became more friends of the process. But we realized this so much on our own that I said to the president of Guatemala, I said, listen, We must go to Mexico to meet with the big opinions.
Yeah.
Because if we leave from here and go back to Washington, to New York, we're going to be, you know, one-sided.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So actually, he landed on a small plane, and we got to Mexico around 9 o'clock that evening.
Okay.
And went directly to the foreign ministry, and they brought the guerrilla leaders, and we, you know, negotiated until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. Now,
and we tried to explain to them
yeah.
that we, there had been certain misunderstanding that we were friends of the process.
Okay.
Not friends of the president, but there was a mistake done by the presidents themselves.
Okay. Who initiated the meeting in Guatemala with the president of Guatemala? Was it the president of Guatemala's initiation, or
no,
was it the president?
Because they offered him.
Oh, I
when he said, listen, we're going to send our ambassadors
okay.
to meet with you. When? As soon as possible. So, I mean, I got a call.
Uh-huh.
That day I left for Guatemala.
I see. Okay. So the idea really came from the...
Who's my wife?
Hi, how are you?
So the idea yeah. actually came from the presidents of the countries, rather than from Boutros Ghali.
Right, and I think okay. it came because the president of Guatemala said...